This is PCJ Radio International.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perron.
Well, hello, friends and listeners, and welcome to the monthly edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International.
Hello, everyone. I'm Komla Dumont. Welcome to Focus on Africa. Here are our top stories tonight. Is there a risk of genocide? A top UN official warns the conflict in the Central African Republic is looking increasingly like Rwanda and Bosnia. A BBC team in the northwest of the country has witnessed the tensions firsthand.
That was Ghanaian-born BBC journalist Komla Dumont hosting the last edition of Focus on Africa on the BBC on Friday, January the 17th. On the 18th, on Saturday, he died at his home in London from a heart attack at age 41. Many people were shocked by this because he wasn't ill. He just had a heart attack. And within minutes of his passing and the announcement, condolences started coming in from around the world, most notably his own country, Ghana, where he began his work at a radio station called Joy FM. Komla Dumont is a person within the BBC that people speak highly of. He was a big man with a big voice and also had a big heart. One of those who has fond memories of him is BBC reporter Lise Doucette. And this is what she had to say.
You know, I always say television doesn't lie. Just look at Komla Dumont, look at his winning smile, look at his sort of big-hearted ways, look at the enthusiasm. He reported with authority and also with affection. He made friends wherever he went. I first met Komla in his native Ghana in 2007. He had just joined the BBC's African service. And even then, I thought, this is a man of great talent. He's going to go a long way. So when he came to London, I made sure that when he started in radio, that people, the editors at television, also knew that Komla Dumont was in town and he should be taken notice of. And he embraced every new challenge. He was a great colleague, a great friend, and a great broadcaster. And he's going to be missed by all of us. And missed, as you heard in that report by Mike Waldris, he really made a difference, African. I used to cheer him on just reading the comments on his Facebook page. You know, they saw Komla Dumont as a big man in every way. He was a passionate football supporter. He was a pious Christian. He was a family man. But he was a great supporter of Africa. He didn't flinch from asking the tough questions. We often talked about the importance of how we do our journalism, how we frame our questions. But he looked for the light as well as the dark. And I think that is how I will always remember him.
And as a person, he was a gentle giant of a man.
You know, a bear hug, a big bear hug from Komla all the time. Every time I saw that the promotional ad that he did on the BBC World TV, wherever I was in the world, and I go to places where there's not a lot to smile about, Komla's ad would come onto TV and I'd break into a smile, because the last bit they didn't have, he talked about he takes his journalism seriously and he takes his audiences seriously, but then he talked about how his suit was really cool and there was nothing wrong with that. Now you're saying, I couldn't get away with doing that kind of an ad, but Komla Dumont could. He had brimming with confidence, brimming with personality, a vibrant, vibrant person, which is why we've just been so shocked by this news and the shock in many parts of the world that we've lost such a great man, such a great person.
Very sad for his family, his colleagues. But in Africa, he was somebody as well that a lot of young people looked up to.
Even when I met him in 2007, I noticed, even though he was a young journalist then, just beginning out, but he'd made his name on talk radio in Ghana, on Joy FM, and I could see the admiration in the eyes of the young Ghanaian journalist who trailed around. In fact, I used to tease Komla all the time when one of the young journalists came my way, and I said, well, are you working with Komla Dumont? And he said, I'm in his entourage. So forever after that, I teased Komla that he traveled with an entourage.
You mentioned that you heard him on talk radio and you immediately spotted that there was somebody that was very suited to take his career into television as well. What was it in particular about him as a professional that you saw and heard?
Well, I think it's because, first of all, he has a very distinctive voice. It's a voice which carries a lot of authority. But also it's his smile. You immediately can relate to him. When you see him on the screen, you think, he's a nice person, but I also trust this person to tell me the news. So it's that combination. Not every broadcaster has it, but he had this unique combination of being able to have a good laugh at things, but also be serious about the things that matter. And there were a lot of things that mattered in his life. Most of all, I have to say, his family. And what is most heartbreaking about the love for his young children, he would write stories about them on Facebook. And clearly his family mattered a lot. And tonight in his native Ghana, there'll be mourning right across the country.
And we talked about some of the memories with him stripping off his formal suit to show his soccer allegiances.
Isn't that amazing?
What would be your abiding memory, do you think?
Just being in Kumla's presence. I think just meeting him, those first meetings in Ghana. It was the 50th anniversary of Ghana's independence from Britain, and just seeing him then in his first years as a journalist, and they always carried with me because he never really changed as a person. He became, of course, much more prominent as a broadcaster, but essentially he remained the same, just warm, friendly, supportive Kumla, and we're all going to miss him terribly.
BBC reporter Lise Doucette talking about her fondest memories of BBC presenter Kumla Dumont, who died at his home in London at age 41 on January the 18th. We now move to China. This past week, China has been in the news a lot. First, over its economy. Second, and very importantly, the trial of human rights activist Xu Jiyong in Beijing. Now, it is obvious that a high-profile trial like this will grab the attention of international media. But the trial itself started to be a shadow of what really happened. There were a number of reporters who went to the courthouse to report on it. And, well, despite the fact that they were given permission to be at the location on January the 20th, it seems that the police were not notified about this. This is what happened to Martin Patience as he was reporting on the trial from the street.
We go now live to our correspondent, Martin Patience, who's close to the courthouse in Beijing. Martin, his approach was seemingly pretty moderate. It still got him in terrible trouble.
Well, that's right. It was pretty moderate, and he's currently being tried in the building just behind me. You might be able to see, Mike, there's been a heavy police presence. In fact, I was pushed up this street about an hour ago by three policemen. That said, now it seems to have calmed down, but Xu Jiyong was working within this system. He wanted China, the Chinese institutions, to push through the rule of law. But, well, Mike, as you can see there, we're having some trouble here from the police. They're pushing the camera away. Why are we not allowed to film outside? We're not being allowed to film outside the building. I'm just staying with you. Excuse me. This is the kind of trouble you get covering Chinese trials in China. It's incredible, the harassment and intimidation. That trial is going on. We don't know what's happening there because diplomats aren't being allowed into the courtroom. And as you can see, outside journalists are getting harassed. Just about an hour or so ago, I saw some activists. Excuse me, who are you? And you've got undercover thugs. What often happens in China is you get men dressed like this. Excuse me, why am I not allowed to cover this? Why am I not allowed to stand outside the court building when China is talking about implementing the rule of law? This is the kind of harassment you face in the country. I mean, the irony of all of this is the activists, they're on trial for fighting against corruption. Xi Jinping has launched a high-profile anti-corruption campaign, but the people speaking out on the issue, well, they're being locked up. And most diplomats, most analysts think that Xu Jiyong will almost certainly be found guilty of the charges he faces.
You've got people all around the world saying well done to you and your team for keeping going during that. Well, we should make the point, shouldn't we, that this dissident and others have basically been trying to implement China's constitution, but it's absolutely clear from the treatment you've just received, this is a very sensitive issue for the government.
Well, it's a hugely sensitive issue, and I think the reason it's sensitive is because of organised. They've been carrying out guerrilla-style protests, holding up banners, calling on President Xi Jinping to make officials publicly declare their assets. Now, the authorities acknowledge that this is a huge problem, but the point is the ruling Communist Party wants to do it in its terms. It wants to control the narratives, and as soon as people start organising, outside of the system, well, they very, very quickly run into trouble. They face the kind of harassment that you just saw a couple of minutes ago.
The BBC's Martin Patience reporting from Beijing on the trial of Xu Jiyong, a human rights activist. Now, on January the 20th, they were given permission by the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs to cover it, but from the street. Media, especially foreign media and foreign diplomats, were not allowed in the courthouse. But despite that, it just seems that that information had not been handed down to the police. The same thing happened to a Sky News reporter.
An extraordinary morning here in Beijing. We're at the number one intermediate court in the west of the city, and we've witnessed over the past 2 hours the treatment of people who are willing and brave enough, if you like, to speak out against the Chinese government. Just about 20 minutes ago, just over there, a group of 20 or so activists who were supporting the people who are in the court right now, and the courthouse is behind me over the other side of the road. They put up banners. Those banners were quickly torn down. They were then asked to get in police vans or taken into police vans, and from there they were taken away. And you could see a gentleman here from the police is actually trying to stop us from doing what we're doing now. This is... I hope you can still see us. We'll move back a bit so I can try and explain the background to the story. Xu Jiyong, if you can still hear me. Well, I suppose I just give you a sense of what it's about. You've got here a plainclothes official. This has been going on all morning. We haven't been able to get up live until now. These people work for the Chinese government. They've been preventing us from filming. We haven't got any access to the court itself. We tried to put up our live position the other side of the road, and my colleague Andy Porch was wrestled to the ground at one point. His blue card, as we call it, their press cards that we all have to carry, has been taken away from him. They tried to take away our tapes. Didn't manage to in this case. I suppose what's happening to journalists is a side issue given what's happening to the activists themselves. It's all about Xu Jiyong, Hannah. He is a very well-known academic from Beijing University. He was arrested in July last year. Once again, you could see the plainclothes officials trying to move us on. Xu Jiyong was arrested in July last year for trying to speak out against the government. Oddly, he was trying... I'm just trying to explain the story. Is that okay? Xu Jiyong was trying to expose corruption in China, and as he did, he was arrested. He's on trial in this courthouse now, and this, Hannah, is the sort of thing we have to deal with on a daily basis when we try to report what the Chinese government doesn't appear to want us to report. I think we'll probably hand it back to you now. Why can't I report this? I'm allowed to be here. We are allowed to report here. Why are we not allowed to report this? Why am I not allowed to stand here? Yeah, it's very strange, you know, trying to report a court case in China. This is what happens. I will try and explain the background to it because it is important. As I said, Xu Jiyong, the leader of a movement in China, which was trying to expose corruption. The irony, of course, is that the Chinese president himself has said he wants to expose corruption. He wants to arrest people who are corrupt. And at the top levels of government, that's what they've been doing. But when anyone lower down in society tries to expose what they perceive as corruption, they're arrested. That's what's happened to Xu Jiyong.
Now, when I was living in Beijing, foreign reporters had, well, today they're called a blue card, but when I was there, it was a green-colored card. That meant that if you were reporting on something and police came up to you, you could show them the card and they're supposed to just go on their way. It shows that you have permission to be reporting there. Now, the location where this takes place is in western Beijing in an area called Babaoshan. In fact, across the street from this court is China Radio International. Now, they were in a public area. The area had not been closed off. It wasn't a restrictive area. The reporters were going to the area that they were told to go to by the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs. They were allowed to go right to the gate to do their live bits, and that was it. They weren't allowed to enter the grounds or enter the courthouse. But that doesn't seem to always work out the way it should. Now, many times when I was in China reporting on events, we would get a memo from the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs to say, look, there's this happening, you can't go there, but you're allowed to report on it from this area. And the reporters did follow the law in that regard. But it just seems, and this is not the first time it has happened, that this information is not trickled down to the police. Now, when these high-profile events take place, there are two types of police that you see. First, the armed military police. You see the Beijing police. And then you see, I wouldn't even call them plainclothes police. They're more like thugs or gangsters that kind of step in front of cameras or open up umbrellas in front of cameras so you can't really see of what's going on. So this is not the first time. Now, one of the reporters that was roughed up quite a bit, and in fact, they even broke the camera, was CNN reporter David McKenzie. And this is how it played out.
So we're heading towards a court in Beijing where a prominent activist goes on trial today. Why? This is a public space. There's no need to shout at me. So the court is just behind us. The name of the activist is Xu Jirong. And the reason he's in trial is because he had a gathering of people several times and was one of the founders of the New Citizens Movement. That is why there are all these police surrounding me here. We're going to go try look at the entrance of the court, which is just here.
Hello?
Sorry, you can't stop me.
It's all right. Soon the situation violently escalated. Police and plainclothes men targeting us, taking away our phones and ID, and breaking the camera.
Yeah, you can't physically... They're physically manhandling us. They're physically manhandling me. This is a public space. I'm allowed to report. I'm allowed to report.
We are reporters. We are reporting in a public space.
Ow. Do not physically manhandle us.
Other international journalists were roughed up during the trial. One policeman told me they were following orders. They've moved us from the van into a police car. A government spokesman said they will investigate the incident, but that without law and order, there will be, quote, chaos in China.
The police and the plainclothes guys drove us to the street corner several blocks away from the court and then just dumped us on the side of the street. We would be shooting this with our camera, but they entirely tore off the front section of the viewfinder so Charlie can't use it at all. This really shows how much China wants to manage the message. But in doing so, the irony is they betray some of the strong arm tactics they use against journalists, including us, and obviously it's often far worse for Chinese nationals. David McKenzie, CNN, Beijing.
Now, what is interesting about this is that every year there are over 300 incidents involving foreign journalists in China, either being roughed up by the police or thugs. Now, this is despite the fact that the Chinese Foreign Ministry has made promises that they won't interfere as long as people follow the law. And the reporters that were on the scene that we just heard and others had been following the law. A reporter from NHK was roughed up, including one from ABC Television. That's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. So this is obviously a bit of a problem. Now, things, especially over the last few years, since the 2008 Olympic Games, have actually been getting worse. The Beijing Foreign Correspondents Club has reported that there has been an increase of incidents like this of more than 20%. The other thing that we have to look at here is, if we go back to before the 2008 Games, the Chinese government had promised that for the 2008 Games, no internet websites would be blocked. Well, on the first day of the Games, as we reported on this program, well, websites were blocked. So what is going on here? Well, it has to do with the way China is administered. Now, many people think that Beijing holds all the power. This is partially true. The truth is, it's that it's the local officials that do hold most of the power. Many times a reporter in Beijing will, let's say, travel to another part of the country, and perhaps Beijing gave him permission to travel to that part of the country to do a story. But he gets there, and he finds out it's a totally different thing. It has to do with exercising of power. You see, local officials in China need to show that they're powerful. So quite often, what they will do is they don't really follow the lead of Beijing. Beijing will say, we're going to investigate it, but that's all that really happens. It's sort of a, how would I put, a smokescreen to say that, well, we're not going to investigate it because it's too much trouble for us. And this is where the problem lies. You see, Beijing doesn't want to really upset local officials in other parts of the country, for the simple reason that when they meet for their annual party meeting, if they do upset local officials, officials don't have to vote on certain things, or won't vote on certain things. So it's trying to keep everybody happy. But at the same time, we have seen, time and time again, China promise to the world that they're going to open up more, they're going to allow more transparency, but then they do something like this. Now, if, for example, the police had not taken the action against Sky, BBC, CNN International, and the other foreign correspondents that were trying to cover this, guess what would happen? The story would have gone on the air, and nobody would have heard anything maybe a few days later, and people would have forgotten it. But you see, this is something that China doesn't seem to understand. Every time they take an action like they did, it brings more media attention. A few times when I was living in China, I would have government officials say to me, why is the Western media so critical of us? What did we do now? And I said, well, because you blocked them, the actions that your people took, this has created a story. So, have they learned anything? Well, you would think that after more than 20 years since they've opened in 1989, that they would have learned this. But no, they haven't. A lot of people were worried when Hu Jintao took over as president of China from Jiang Zemin in the early 2000s. Well, what happened is the crackdown on the media actually tightened up. The new president that we've seen so far has actually taken a tougher line. Recently in China, somebody told me on one of a trip that I went there just a couple of weeks ago, they said, you know what? We take 3 steps forward and then we take 10 steps backward. And this is exactly what is happening. Now, just before this story turned out, two administrations in China, the Department of Propaganda for the Chinese Communist Party and the State Administration of Film, Radio, and Television, sent a memo to all television and radio stations in China to warn them not to report on this story. I'm talking about the story of the trial of the human rights activist. They were told, it doesn't exist. Don't report on it, and if you do, you will get in trouble. But foreign media, on the other hand, they took a very different approach. In fact, they invited them to go to the courthouse and said, sure, you have permission to go there. You can set up your camera for your live shots in front of the courthouse, and then this happens. So there's certainly a problem somewhere. And you're listening to the monthly edition of Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. World Business Report is a very popular program on the BBC World Service. Earlier this month, they did a special on shortwave. Yes, shortwave. On a business program? It was very surprising. Well, what they did is they sent their reporter, Lucy Burton, to Romania to talk about the future and if it really does have a future.
American Chamber of Commerce.
Do you recognize this sound? It's shortwave radio, and some of the biggest announcements of the 20th century were heard through the crackles and the hiss of these radio waves. Twiddling the dials, you could learn about crises, coups, and the Cold War. But as technology advances, the future for this once vital method of communication looks uncertain. This is the sound of their vast Radio Liberty transmitters being demolished on the Costa Brava in Spain in 2006. They once relayed news from the United States to people living under the iron fist of the Soviet Union. But now that the Cold War is over, is there still a need for shortwave? For the last 85 years, Radio Romania has beamed its message around the world from its headquarters in Bucharest. But for how much longer? The Radio Romania building is imposing and austere, with marble floors and staircases. It's a huge building, there are 8 floors, and about 2,000 people work here. Off each of the long corridors are studios broadcasting in several different languages, including English, French, Arabic, and of course, Romanian.
Este ora 17. Bună ziua, sunt Adriana Leu, ascultați știrile. Guvernul
Ian Irina Adamescu is the editor in charge of the foreign languages here at Radio Romania, and we're chatting to her in the most incredible wooden panelled studio. The door is incredibly heavy and has a sort of porthole window that the team on the other side can look through. We've got three microphones in the middle of a table and some headphones as well. And today Irina is this side of the microphone and not telling people what to do on the other side of it. But Irina, tell me a little bit about Radio Romania International. Why is it important for the station to broadcast in so many different languages to all of these different countries?
Am constatat că există o deficiență de informare.
We've noticed that there's a lack of information, especially in Western countries, about Romania. The information is either absent or negative. It's important for us to broadcast from Bucharest about news, politics, or day-to-day life. We need to show the country as it is.
Radio Romania is one of the last stations in Europe to still broadcast in shortwave. Do you ever get any listener response from people abroad listening in shortwave, and what do they say about it?
When we celebrated 85 years of broadcasting, we asked our listeners about the future of international radio. We received about 200 letters from the areas we transmit to, and all of them asked us to keep broadcasting in shortwave.
Continuare pe unde scurte.
When I listen to shortwave, I find it very crackly and difficult to listen to. Do you think that it's something that a medium that will continue for a long time?
Cred că va mai continua și cred că va trebui să
I believe it will continue, but we need to differentiate between the areas we use it in. Most of our listeners to our French programmes are in the Maghreb area, as well as the Central African countries. For economic reasons, our African listeners won't be using the internet anytime soon, so we do need to carry on with shortwave. This isn't the case in Europe, where people listen on the internet. But I do think it's important to keep it running in case of emergencies.
But what does Irene's boss think? In his plush wood-panelled office with views of the imposing Palace of the Parliament, I asked Director-General Ovidiu Michelescu whether shortwave has any distinct advantage over more modern methods of broadcasting.
For modern radio, it's very useful for different territories without any other source or channel to listen, but these short waves can be replaced with success by FM, AM, digital, satellite, internet. But don't forget that there are many isolated areas or very low developed areas around the world, in Africa, in South America, in Russia. Because if we are looking on the map who use short waves, we will see that in this territory the presence are very active. But I don't think that short waves will have a future in radio.
You don't think that there'll be a future?
No, I don't think so.
Because?
Because of increase of IT infrastructure, they are developing day by day, not from year to year or month by month. And I am sure that in a more isolated area around the world, not in a very long time, another type of access to information, to media, will arrive.
So how much longer will Radio Romania use shortwave for?
I think that in the next maximum 3 years, I think it will be history.
That's unwelcome news to enthusiasts like Glenn Hauser.
World of Radio is a listener-supported public service program about communications around the world, primarily shortwave.
He's a radio show host from Oklahoma in the United States.
Bahrain, Brazil, Cuba, Equatorial Guinea.
His weekly show, World of Radio, takes a look at what's been happening in the world of shortwave radio.
Shortwave has a tremendous advantage in that it's a direct connection, or almost direct, between the station and the listener. There's no intermediary. It's coming right through the ionosphere, bouncing from one part of the world to another. Some countries try to block shortwave by jamming, which is somewhat effective, but they can't cut it off or interrupt it, as is the case with broadcasting via internet. It's an old technology, but it is efficient.
I suppose the question is there a commercial reason to keep shortwave going?
Apparently many shortwave or former shortwave broadcasters think there is not. Of course, it does involve an expense of running many kilowatt hours of electricity into the ionosphere, and that is an expense the stations have to pay.
So other than, I suppose, preserving this kind of once fantastic piece of broadcasting equipment, is it just perhaps enthusiasts that want to keep it going?
Well, it's the enthusiasts we know about and we hear from. Unfortunately, there is not a very effective way to do audience research on shortwave to know how many people are really out there listening and may not be, quote, enthusiasts who make their presence known.
So there could be far more people that rely on it.
Yes, and even, I'm sure this varies depending on the situation, but shortwave is a reliable backup means, if nothing else, for reaching listeners, and it should be kept available, if not in full use, by many different stations.
Do you see a day when there are no shortwave transmitters left at all?
I really doubt that. There certainly has been attrition, and a number of stations have closed down, but there are many small stations which still use shortwave. And by the way, although a number of relay sites in our North American area, or in the Americas, have closed down, unfortunately, there's been a recent development in that one has been revived, and it's the largest one in the Western Hemisphere at Okeechobee, Florida. And now they have 13 shortwave transmitters available, which could carry all kinds of stations from overseas if they would just make use of them for relays. And I wish one of those would be the BBC World Service. We miss it very much from being able to just turn on a radio and hear it.
Another factor of concern is the low level of tax collection.
As Mr. Hauser points out, shortwave gets to people and places that the internet cannot, either because of a lack of infrastructure or because governments simply block the content. But in a world of austerity and cost-cutting, radio stations are under increasing pressure to make savings where they can. And the giant masts that transmit shortwave are often the first to fall. But its supporters continue to hope that this form of broadcasting will be with us just a little bit longer.
Lucy Burton, reporting. Now, over the last 20 years, health reporting has become something that is very popular. Many news programs around the world on radio and television have health reports. The problem, though, is with health news always changing, what do you do? Because one minute they can say, oh, this is bad for you. And then a few years later, they say, it's good for you. And then one day they say, oh, this is good for you. And then later they say, it's bad for you. Different universities have one study, another university and doctor has another study, and both of them contradict themselves. So how do you report on it? And what do you believe? Well, David H. Friedman is a Boston-based journalist and author. He's the author of a book called Wrong: Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. He speaks next to our friend Richard Ady.
This Thursday, a breakthrough in research into children's allergies.
I consume butter, I don't consume margarine.
British researchers have found an average television chef's recipe is not as healthy as a ready-to-eat.
Energy, protein, fat, and saturated fat.
And a new review of an old study raises questions about the long-held view.
They used 5 cookbooks, including one by Jamie Oliver.
The risk factors have been hard to explain until now.
A new Australian study has found a link between breastfeeding in the first...
Polyunsaturated fats found in margarines are better for preventing heart disease than saturated fats.
It's bewildering trying to keep up with consumer health news via the media. You don't have to wait too long to hear or read contradictory reports on what you should eat, what you shouldn't, which exercise is good, which you shouldn't do. The end result is confusing and deeply unhelpful. David Friedman believes it's even worse than that. The longtime health and technology writer argues that the least reliable health research is what's reported. And the problem, he says, isn't caused by sloppiness.
I don't think accuracy is the problem. I think, in fact, a lot of it is quite accurate. In fact, that's really the problem. It's so accurate that what it's doing is it's transmitting wrong findings from scientific studies. It turns out that most scientific published findings don't, in fact, hold up over time. And so when science journalists transmit them accurately, they are, in effect, transmitting bad information to the world.
So you're talking about research findings that are in often quite prestigious publications, and they turn out to be, what, wrong?
Yeah, and of course, there's really wrong, as in flat-out wrong, and there's milder forms of wrong, such as exaggerated. The claims maybe hold up, but just not nearly as strongly as originally claimed. And yes, we're talking about an absolutely the tip of the pyramid when it comes to prestigious science journals. And the very best journals, at least in medicine, you have close to a two-thirds wrongness rate, and it goes up in other journals.
But why is this?
It has to do with, really, at root, how tough science is, and in particular, how tough medical science is. Human beings are extremely complex. Biology is extremely complex. There are some easier problems in biology and health, and we've solved them all. And so what we're left with is the very toughest problems in a very difficult, messy science. And unfortunately, it's not easy for scientists to make a career out of coming out and saying, we don't know what's going on, we haven't really understood this yet. It's much easier to have a career as a scientist if you say, I have this definite finding. And that's what the publications look to publish, and that's what science journalists look to pass on.
Yeah, because you can imagine the publications, they want to publish the most interesting bits of research, don't they? And the most interesting bits of research are going to be the ones that are maybe counterintuitive or surprising.
That's exactly right. And it's a little hard to grasp this at first, but when you think about it, the reason something is surprising and interesting is typically because it's likely to be wrong. So if I tell you that I saw my cousin on the bus yesterday, you wouldn't find that a very interesting story. If I told you I spotted Elvis on the bus yesterday, well, that would be interesting, except you'd be pretty sure I'd be wrong about it. And this same simple phenomenon plays out in science. We like to hear the interesting stories. They're likely to be wrong.
So the scientists want to tell the most interesting stories, although they won't think of it that way. They'll think, well, I'll do this interesting research because it's more likely to be published. And then the publications are more likely to choose the most interesting of them, which means the health journalists are looking at the most interesting of the most interesting stories when it comes to deciding what they're going to write about and put in the paper or on TV.
That's right. And so what happens is science journalists aren't causing the problem of wrongness. They're essentially amplifying it. So we've got a problem right away with the science journals. So if the public read science journals, which of course most of them do not, they're very hard to read, then already we'd have a big problem. If science journalists are taking the most interesting, most novel, most provocative findings from those studies and giving those the most play in the media, then they are, in effect, picking the worst of the worst, and we get terrible health information.
How aware of this, then, are the health reporters? Because, really, they, if they've been in it for more than a year or two, they ought to know this.
That's a difficult question to answer. Interestingly, scientists themselves are completely on board with this. I learned this from scientists. Scientists are very open about this. Science journalists are not so sure. I mean, after all, this is threatening their very enterprise, and a lot of them are quite defensive about it and don't seem to grasp it. Others say, well, of course we know this is true, but there's nothing we can do about it. I really disagree with that. I think there's a lot we can do about it.
But I'm not wrong in thinking, am I, that there is a real tendency to report the latest research as if it's the complete truth. That's it. Game over. No more discussion. We now know everything about this.
You see that a lot, and that is just absolutely the worst way to report any sort of scientific finding, or almost any sort of scientific finding, especially within medicine, where we know there are such high wrongness rates. So all these results really should be published with a lot of qualifiers and with a general spirit of, hey, this is perhaps interesting. It could turn out to be right, although chances are pretty good it'll just be one more finding that won't quite get it right, but we can just take it as one more data point.
It explains why ordinary readers who are interested in health get confused about things, especially things like coffee, red wine, losing weight.
So a lot of bad things happen when people read this stuff. There are a number of choices that readers can make when they're presented with this stuff. They can latch on to one of them because they find it the best solution for their lifestyle and just become believers in it. And chances are they've latched on to a bad solution that will not help their health. On the other hand, they can sort of go the opposite route, see all the conflicting results, and then say, well, I give up. I guess scientists don't really get this at all. There's nothing I can do. And that's a bad attitude, too. It's not their fault, but that's really not the best way to deal with your health.
I know you're especially interested in obesity. Big problem in your country, big problem in this one too, and the way it's reported across the media. I can't, off the top of my head, name the different number of diet approaches that have been canvassed in the media as perhaps the answer over the last 4 or 5 years.
And not only have we seen just this massive stream of supposed diet solutions, all backed, mind you, by scientific studies, come at the public, you have a lot of science journalists, sometimes backed by scientists, who will absolutely declare that they have the answer and everybody else is wrong. I think this is absolutely appalling that science journalists are taking part in this sort of debacle because obesity is killing people. It's robbing the planet of millions and millions of person years of life. And it's a serious problem. There are solutions to it, and we really shouldn't be latching on to some of these silly, faddish solutions that are pitched by some science journalists.
So where does that leave us with regard to, because in this country, our National Health and Medical Research Council has published the latest dietary guidelines this week. It's a bit of a change. Of course, the media is enthusiastically reporting them. Should we be taking them with a grain of salt?
Well, better a grain of salt than a blob of fat, I guess. But I think what we've seen is dietary guidelines that have shifted a lot over the years. In many ways, they've almost reversed from what we were hearing as late as the 1990s. But I do think it's true we're slowly zooming in on a better set of dietary guidelines. The evidence is piling in. Consensus is slowly building. We do have a much better idea now of the kind of diets, first of all, that are likely to help us from being obese, and second of all, and this is critical, that people are likely to be able to stick with. Now, that's a critical distinction that a lot of science journalists and scientists fail to make, which is a healthy diet that will keep us from being obese is useless if most people won't be able to stick with it. So we're getting better guidelines now, and I think people do need to pay attention to them.
What should health and science journalists be doing? What should they be doing better that they're not doing now?
I do think that science journalists do need to keep accurately reporting the results of scientific studies for the simple reason of what else can we do? We can't outthink the scientists on this one. However, I think we should constantly be reminding our readership that much as you have a warning on every pack of cigarettes, there should be a warning essentially that comes with science journalism articles that remind the readers, scientists are doing their best to get at very difficult answers, and along the way, most of what they come up with typically doesn't hold up. So pay attention. Maybe there's something interesting here, but don't jump onto the wagon of believing this is going to be the solution that will solve anything. And now they don't literally have to say all that, but that should be the spirit of the reporting as opposed to latest study finds, now we know the answer. That really can be deadly advice.
But that's the equivalent of having a disclaimer saying, this may turn out to be completely wrong. No journalist is going to want to do that.
And any journalist who does is going to have a serious conversation with their editor or producer who's going to say, and you want me to run this? Why? And as a matter of fact, I think what has to happen is science journalists have to call on their creativity as writers, as reporters, to find a way to sell this story, to continue to publish these stories and make them interesting, even though they're not sold as the honest-to-God bottom-line truth.
It happens in other areas, in other beats or rounds, doesn't it? We don't pretend that actually this is carved in stone and you don't need to ever read anything else about this. We always make it clear that this is part of something that's evolving and changing over time.
Frustratingly to me, some of the realms in which we're most skeptical, such as, for example, the business world, and especially the world of politics, reporters do a great job of being very skeptical. Of course, we expect that of our reporters in politics and business. It's ironic that in the world of science, where we should really be doing a great job of not misleading our readers and trying to get them as close to the truth as we can, where we have journalists who don't bring that sort of skepticism and those sorts of qualifications to their reportings for the most part. And that really needs to change.
I wonder if, though, that's because science has been a robust and effective way of answering questions about ourselves and the universe. And that means that the journalists have almost forgotten that they have to be skeptical as well, because the scientists have already done the skepticism for them.
I think what happens is that most science journalists are not scientists. They typically might have a college degree, an undergraduate degree, as we say here in the U.S., in science. And so what they've done is they've learned science from textbooks and lectures. If you continue on and get your PhD and become a genuine working scientist, you do research, and lo and behold, you learn how messy and frequently, in fact, most of the time, wrong science is. And so scientists have really no problem with this. Science journalists have a much bigger problem. And so, yes, they themselves either forget or don't really understand, never did quite grasp, that science really is not typically very effective at getting at the truth on very complex subjects. It may be the best way we have of getting at it, but it's still not a great one. It doesn't really turn up the right answers most of the time.
So actually what you want is a big change in how scientists and health researchers are regarded by health journalism. Instead of infallible heroes, more flawed humans. It's a very human enterprise, science.
Well, and that seems like a simple, very palatable point to make. I mean, who wants to claim that scientists aren't human beings like the rest of us? And yet you really do see a very strong element in science reporting of treating the people we cover as our sacred heroes, who would never mislead us, who are the sacred givers of the truth. Scientists don't see themselves that way. They never talk about themselves that way, or almost never. And it's really silly for us science journalists to do the same. But one of the things I like to point out is that science journalists are just about the only kinds of journalists who brag about getting awards from the people they cover. I think that's great to get an award, but come on, what does that say about conflict of interest, about skepticism and wariness of who we're covering?
That was journalist and author David H. Freeman, who wrote a book called Wrong: Why Experts Keep Failing Us and How to Know When Not to Trust Them. He was speaking there with our good friend Richard Ady. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, if you want to listen to this program again or catch all past editions, I mean, going way back when the show started, it's easy to do. Just go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/media-network-plus. Now, we would also want to find out how you're listening to the show, if you're listening to us on FM, medium wave, shortwave, or the internet. If you are listening on shortwave, do let us know what frequency and at what time, and send us an email, mnp@pcjmedia.com, and you'll receive a QSL card for the program. And that's only for those who are listening on shortwave.
It's terribly sad but true. I'm all dressed up and no place to go. This evening I'm awfully blue. I must wear some winsomeness. Can't go on like this. I could blossom out, I know, with somebody just like you. Cause, oh, cute and lovely lady, be good. Oh, lady, be good to me. I am so awfully misunderstood. Oh, lady, be good to me. Oh, please have some pity. I'm all alone in this big city. I'm just a lonesome babe in the woods. Oh, lady, be good to me.
All right, well, it's now time to take a look at what we can expect propagation-wise over the next 7 days. Here's Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation for the week starting on January 25th, 2014 to January 31st, 2014. The 10.7 centimeter flux starts out on January 25th at 135, up 10 points to 145 on January 26th, January 27th and 28th, 160, January 29th, 155, January 30th and 31st, 150. The A index is 5 for the first 3 days of the week, January 25th to January 27th. On January 28th, up 5 points with the A index to 10, up 8 more points, spiking at 18 on January 29th, down 10 points to 8 on January 30th, and on January 31st, an A index of 5. The KP index will be 2 for the first 3 days of this week. That's January 25th to January 27th. January 28th, up 1 more to 3. Up 1 more point on January 29th to 4, down 1 to 3 on January 30th, down 1 more to 2 on January 31st. 9 sunspots present for us this week with a huge clustering of spots to the sun's western region. This cluster of spots are 1958, 59, 60, 63, and 64. Sunspots to the east are 1952, 55, 57, and 61. 2 sunspots facing Earth, AR 1957 and AR 1959, have beta-gamma magnetic fields that harbor energy for M-class solar flares. NOAA forecasters estimate a 30% chance of M-class flares by January 22nd. To the north-northeast region of the Sun is a large coronal hole blowing a stream of solar wind, and we are right inside it. This means aurora activity. A coronal mass ejection should have happened by January 23, 2014. NOAA forecasters estimate a 25% chance of polar geomagnetic storms. For more, go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/RPROP. Back to you, Keith.
All right, thanks a lot, Dan. Well, guess what? We're now out of time. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. And you can listen to this edition again, as well as our weekly edition, through our website at www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. And to find out where the show's airing, you can also visit the website, and you can also listen to us on the World Radio Network at www.wrn.org. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Perron wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. 73 and 88 to the ladies.
Bye.